Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 1st of April, opening day of baseball here in the state of Wisconsin, and time for all things political. We'll have two guests with us this hour. Jill Lawrence is national correspondent for the National Journal. Later in the hour, Lenny McAllister, author and conservative commentator. Jill is managing editor for politics for National Journal, is an award-winning analyst, columnist, and commentary writer who has covered every single presidential election since 1988. She's also contributed to the Daily Beast, to the Atlantic, and other online and print publications. She is with us for the first half hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Jill. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's great to be here.
Are you going late to the Easter egg event?
I won't be going, and nor will I be going to opening day of the Nationals either, sadly.
Oh, Jill, what will you be doing?
well, working.
Working. Yeah, I'd like to be going to opening day, too, though, although I've gone to my share, and gol darn it, it's always cold here. At least there's a roof on our stadium, but it's always cold.
Aw.
Yeah. Well, has a deal been reached on immigration reform or not?
Well, that depends on who you listen to. Most people involved in the negotiations seem to think that that it's all over, but the details, of course, you know, the details can sometimes be very tough to work out. There was a consensus that there was a lot of progress made late last week with an agreement between business and labor about how to deal with future flow of immigrants coming in and how to make sure it matches up with the workforce that's needed. So that was a big step, but still details need to be worked out with that, and language needs to be worked out for the whole package. So you did have some people really trying to put the brakes on, notably Marco Rubio.
I guess one of the stumbling points may be, what is the path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants? Do they have that worked out?
They seem to be getting there. What they seem to be settling on is legal residency followed by meeting targets of the border, you know, enforcement at the border, followed by a path to citizenship, which does not put them ahead of people who are trying to get in from outside the country. So, you know, the threat of deportation will be gone. There will be an emphasis on border enforcement, and ultimately, in a long while, there'll be the path to citizenship.
It does seem as though on this issue we've been plagued by a spirit of non-cooperation for a long time now. Things seem to be moving, I guess it would be fair to say, relatively rapidly in this area.
I think that's right. They're planning to unveil their package next week. You know, this is within the first 100 days of the second term of the Obama administration. And so, really, you know, I don't know if you remember that interview that the president did with the Des Moines Register that was supposed to be off the record, that they then put on the record, where he said that if he won, he predicted there'd be fast action on immigration reform just because of the political situation Republicans would find themselves in. They lost the Hispanic vote to Obama 2-3-1 in this last election. And so this is a gateway issue. You know, no one's predicting that they'll suddenly have, you know, a herd of Hispanics coming their way at the polling station, but at least, you know, they won't start off from a position of complete hostility, and they'll be able to make their case.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about North Korea for just a moment. Now saying, you never know what rhetoric you're going to get on any given day, but that North Korea is now in a state of war with South Korea. People in Washington have to be a little worried about this country, don't they?
Well, they are worried. I mean, it's one of many worries. You know, all the emphasis has been on Iran and its nuclear program, and meanwhile, there's North Korea there. I'm sure it's a top level concern. There's some sense, you know, that they're not going to declare war on anyone or go to war, but there are other things that they can do. And the United States has been upping its exercises in the area and just kind of making sure they're aware that we're on alert. So we'll see if there's going to be any progress in any negotiations or whether this is going to continue to percolate at a very tense level.
And what do you think it will be? percolating at a tense level?
Well, you know, there's so much unknown because of this new leader. So I think yes, and I think, you know, they'll probably have to devote more attention to it in addition to keeping tabs on Iran. So it's just one of these situations that never stabilizes.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to gun control for a moment. The president will go to Colorado to campaign for more gun control. What will he be campaigning for exactly?
Well, at the most basic level, he'll be campaigning for votes on these gun control measures. And that would include a Senate package that would expand background checks and expand a program for school safety and tighten penalties, stiffen penalties for gun trafficking. But it also involves votes on amendments that people are going to be bringing up. Three of them off the top of my head are an assault weapons ban, tightening the requirements to report serious mental illness findings, and limiting high-capacity magazines. So it's unclear whether any of those amendments will pass. There's also a group of five Republicans so far who say they're going to filibuster any votes at all. I am not sure that they are going to reach the critical mass they need to block this vote. It's just a question of how persuasive Harry Reid can be, how persuasive the president can be, and he'll be out on the hustings putting some pressure on. So there's also some Michael Bloomberg activity, the mayor of New York, who's very active on this with a political action committee. So he's running ads in the states of some wavering Democrats and Republicans to try to build up some support.
He has put a lot of money into this, hasn't he, Jill?
He sure has. He's putting $12 million into these ads right now, and that doesn't even count what he put in at the end of last year. He's picking his races very carefully, and his most recent race was in Chicago. He got the candidate he wanted in a special primary for a special election. So he's trying to prove that, you know, if you vote against the NRA, there is life after that, political life, and that there is political clout on the other side of the issue.
Mm-hmm. What we're hearing now is that the only thing that is likely to pass is background checks. Would it be fair to say that, or do you think that might even be in trouble?
Well, I know that there's a lot of different problems that certain conservatives have with record keeping and registries and, you know, threats that are both, you know, real and imagined. But Chuck Schumer is trying to work out an arrangement, an agreement with some of the people who have objections, and he seems pretty confident that he's going to get there. I think that there's such overwhelming public support for that, that it's hard to see it going down. That's when 90% of the public supports something. You know, how do you, and you're, and in the Senate in particular, where you're representing whole states and not just districts that are drawn to have, you know, a conservative or liberal bent, it's just hard to see how this could fail. But again, you know, this is the Senate, this is Congress, and this is a very sensitive issue. So we'll see how they go.
Mm-hmm. And what about high-capacity magazines?
You know, that's something that that it seems to make a lot of sense. People in polls support it. If you listen to some of the stories from Newtown, you know, there was one little boy whose mother insisted on an open coffin so people could see what he was shot, you know, numerous times, and just it was a horrible, horrible thing. And she wanted people to see what it does when someone can shoot like that. A lot of it, I hate to say this, could depend on whether the emotions that were running so high after Newtown are revived, you know, whether we can get back into that mindset.
Much as I hate to do it, let's move to the 2016 presidential race, because people are doing that. Are Democrats waiting to see what Hillary is going to do? Do you know what she's going to do?
Well, I think Democrats really do have to wait and see what she's going to do, because she'd be such a prohibitive favorite, just in terms of support and money, if she decides to do it. Now, I have gone out on a huge limb about six weeks ago, saying that I don't think she's going to do it. I don't think she knows if she's going to do it. So at the moment, you know, she's keeping her options open and adjusting to civilian life. You know, she's writing a book. She's starting, I guess, later this month, she'll give her first lecture for a huge fee, no doubt. She does have a little office in Washington. You know, she'll be starting up, everyone expects her to start up some kind of a foundation or a branch of her husband's foundation to help women, third world women in particular. So, you know, she'll be doing a lot of things. She never gets out of the spotlight. But she'll be 69 in 2016. And this is the first time she's kind of been out of public office with money, when she and her husband have both been out of public office. And it's you know, she was very tired and she had some health problems towards the end. So, you know, I vowed I wouldn't write about this for 6 months after I wrote that piece. I guess I'm not breaking my vow to talk about it. But I just, you know, I don't, I think it, some people put it at 50-50. I'm not sure that this is going to happen.
And what about the pressure? I'm wondering if it's already started for Michelle Obama to run for the Senate.
Well, you know, there may be pressure, but I would bet that she's impervious to that sort of thing. She does not like politics very much, based on the experiences of both campaigns that I've witnessed. I think that she's probably looking forward to getting back to private life and to Chicago after this term is up. I mean, both of these women are going to have a huge amount of pressure to do any number of things, and you know, they're just going to have to live their lives the way they want to, ultimately.
Right.
I mean, I hope they will.
Right. Right. And turning to the Republicans of interest to people who live in the state of Wisconsin and nationally, our governor is heading to the Polk County Republican fundraiser, which draws a lot of presidential contenders, which leads one to ask, is he a presidential contender?
Well, you'd know that better than I. There's been a lot of talk about him, and obviously he has some credentials as a, you know, as a conservative hero, conservative icon for withstanding both the backlash and also the recall election. So, and he wasn't making any secret of his interest at the Republican convention. He sort of strikes me as more of a vice presidential type of choice, particularly the state he comes from, you being a swing state and all. Mm-hmm. But he's also a very polarizing figure. So the question is, you know, he has to run for re-election before any of this would happen. And, you know, where does he move on the spectrum, if anywhere? And does he try to depolarize himself?
Jill Lawrence is our first guest for All Things Political. Managing editor for politics for the National Journal. We'll welcome phone calls for her. We have yet to talk about the Supreme Court and so much they'll be deciding. We'll look at we talked a lot about the gay marriage issues. I'm interested in hearing Jill's response. I'm sure she looked at that very carefully. But also, this is a big year for determining some race issues. If the justices strike down federal voting protections, it could be a pivotal year, really, with regard to race in the Constitution. So we'll talk about that as well. Here's how you join us. Lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today. Tonight on Frontline, PBS begins the airing of a two-part program, which is titled Kind-Hearted Woman. It is the story of an Oglala Sioux and member of North Dakota's Spirit Lake tribe who was who is still trying to raise her family as a single mother while confronting her alcoholism and the scars of being sexually abused as a child. It is an extremely riveting five-hour presentation. We'll speak with the director of the film, David Sutherland, and we'll also be speaking with the program director for the Community Transformation Grant at the Great Lakes Intertribal Council. That's coming up, hour two of our show. All right, two phone calls for Jill Lawrence, starting with Jim in Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Hi. I hope you had a nice Easter.
You too.
Yeah, thank you. My question is wondering if the voters have any sense of decency or shame regarding the Supreme Court, because You know, in the past, we've had a situation where Prosser has already been reelected in spite of the fact that the clear-cut situation presented where he even admits that he, quotes, inadvertently, quotes, put his hands on the throat of a Democratic Supreme Court justice. And in the process, you know, the Rogensack, his opponent in this election, says that she pulled the Democratic justice off of away from Prosser, which to me is a clear-cut violation of common sense in the matter, since I believe that Justice Bradley had already, prior to the incident, contacted the security about concerns with the way Prosser operates. And there are many things at stake in this election, including the possible decision on voter registration and voting rights, which could be adversely affected. And we also know that Rogensack has said, in essence, that it was okay for justices not to recuse themselves over issues that would be affected by or would affect the donors to the justices, which to me is clearly inappropriate as well. So the question before the House, I guess, is whether the Democrats are going to be able to really get a turnout that's much stronger than the average election, because if we don't, we're headed for really difficult times.
All right. I'm not sure if Jill has her eyes on this. This is the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, and you may have known that it's had some fairly bizarre stories coming forward on it. The election is tomorrow. You probably haven't followed it that closely or covering national news.
No, although it's always hard to get people interested in judicial elections, although it sounds like if anything would get people interested, it's what's been going on there.
Yes, but let's talk about judicial issues here for a moment. And before we talk about the gay marriage cases, what about these? This was all over the news this weekend, which makes me wonder, is the Supreme Court deciding this pretty soon, race preferences in admissions and federal voting protections?
Well, they've got three cases, and two of them they're going to be deciding by June. So there will be some decisions on that, and it's kind of an interesting situation, particularly after the last election where there was so much to do about voting registration and requirements and what you need, the ID that you need to show when you come to vote, and how long people have to wait on lines. I mean, some of those things were happening in states like Pennsylvania who are not under the Voting Rights Act. So, I mean, I guess you could make an argument that either we don't need this or that we should have it apply to the whole country.
And the lower courts have looked at some of the more restrictive voter ID provisions that have passed recently, and many of them are just on hold. Do all of those go to the Supreme Court at some point, Jill?
You know, there's the Voting Rights Act, I think that Congress would have to really do more oversight and pass things that, you know, unless someone takes something to the Supreme Court as unconstitutional, these state courts have been making the decisions on them. And, for instance, the Pennsylvania court put their law on hold. Some of the federal courts have been getting involved, I think, in South Carolina. So ultimately they could. They haven't gotten there yet. But that could happen if they're perceived as very restrictive or having a disparate impact on, you know, minorities.
It is interesting how the country is changing. When I was reading about the Supreme Court's deliberations on these issues, I was reminded that last year was the first year that more newborn children were minorities than Caucasian children. Isn't that amazing? I mean, the country is really changing.
It's totally changing, and not just, you know, with race and ethnicity, but attitudes as well, as we see with gay marriage. It's an amazing cultural shift that's put some of these cultural issues on the side of the Democrats and liberals for the first time that I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks for your call. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I was reading an article that some states, Wisconsin included, are trying to change the electoral college system to count votes by congressional district rather than popular vote. And if that had been done in this last election, even though Obama had 5 million more votes, Romney would have won the election. Does Jill know anything about that?
Well, that is true, and it's because the makeup of Congress and congressional districts is so political. You know, it's the districts are redrawn after every census, and Republicans actually lost the overall House vote by 1 million votes, but they won a House majority. So, you know, it's a distortion of the system, and you know, the question is whether you want to extend that distortion to the presidential vote. And both parties do it, I should add, Democrats and Republicans. But Republicans swept so many governorships and state legislatures in 2010, right at the time when the redrawing was going on, that they are really in the catbird seat at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Do you imagine, though, let's talk about the refashioning of the Republican Party for just a moment. Another set of midterms will be coming up, and Republicans have to be a little bit worried. I'm wondering what efforts you see to reshape who they are, to rebrand their image, because it simply is necessary to win the midterms and certainly to win the next presidential race.
Well, you do have compromise going on with immigration, and there may be compromises on guns and the budget before the next midterm election. You also have the party trying to tone down some of the rhetoric by some of the more inflammatory members. And you have a kind of a very big divide in the party on gay marriage. You have some very prominent Republicans coming out in support of it and some not. But even the ones who don't support it trying to sound tolerant about those who do. So it's an interesting moment for the party. There just was a Gallup poll that came out this morning that found that the top critique of Americans of the Republican Party is that it's inflexible and unwilling to compromise. And, you know, and 21% of national adults said that. And amazingly, 26% of Republicans thought that about their own party.
So change is in the offing.
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, change or die.
Right. And finally, let's look at the Supreme Court cases on gay marriage. One of the readings is that they will decide narrowly on the Proposition 8, but it would appear to many observers that DOMA is going down. What do you think?
Well, that seems to be how people expect they will rule. I think, you know, that's going to create some questions. It's a mobile country. People move from state to state. There's a lot of chaos that could be unleashed if that's what they do. You know, I guess their alternative is to decide, well, that equal protection under the law means that, yes, you must be able to get married, even if you're two men or two women. And so that would make things very clear. Oftentimes they don't make things very clear. In this case, there seemed to be a lot of support for letting states kind of take this in their own time and in their own way. But that does leave the question of, you know, if a married couple from Massachusetts moves to Alabama or someplace that doesn't have gay marriage, do they file one set of tax returns, joint returns, and the other separate? Do they still get federal benefits? Do they, you know, it's a can of worms.
Mm-hmm. So what will you be looking forward to covering this week other than the Easter egg hunt? And you won't be going to opening day of the Nationals. So
no.
what are you going to be doing, Jill?
I'm really interested in what's going on with all of these potential compromises on economics, on guns, on immigration. I'm interested in the president's trip to Denver on Wednesday and how much he manages to gin up, you know, some support for gun control. I know there's some people who think he's already waited too long, but, you know, he's still within his 100-day window, so. And he's going to places, you know, he went to Connecticut last week, and he's going to the site of two gun massacres on Wednesday to Colorado. And so, you know, I'm very interested in seeing whether Congress and the president are able to reach accommodations on all of this.
Thank you, Jill, so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Jill Lawrence, national correspondent for the National Journal, our first guest. Lenny McAllister is joining us now. Lenny is an author and conservative commentator. He's a public speaker, writer, author. He hosted and produced a couple shows in Chicago on radio, and he is featured on a leading national cable news programs offering a look into modern conservative thought. He's been featured at Tea Party rallies, and he's the author of several books, Diary of a Mad Black PYC, Proud Young Conservative. He does the McAllister Minute, which is a feature of American Urban Radio Network, runs 2 weeks a month on a number of stations all over the country, where he extols conservative values to mostly progressive audiences. He was also featured as one of the 40 under 40 to watch in 2012 by the Chicago Defender. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Lenny, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Lenny. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Good. As long as we started with Jill on baseball, because it's opening day here in Milwaukee, do you have a team, sir?
I have two. I have the White Sox here in Chicago,
yeah.
And then I'm a native Pittsburgher, so I'm hoping that after 20-some-odd years, the Pittsburgh Pirates will finally have a winning season. But, you know, it's kind of like rooting for the Pirates having a winning season. It's kind of like rooting for the Cubs to win a World Series. It's kind of one of those things that you do just because you're caught into a cycle, but you don't really expect it to happen.
I grew up rooting for the White Sox, so they're my second team now. I'm with you.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
There you go. Let's start with immigration reform. What are you hearing about there being a compromise here being reached? And what do you think about the whole process of Democrats and Republicans working on this issue together, which it would appear they're doing so pretty seriously?
I think, number one, the Republican Party realizes that if they're going to be relevant with the next presidential cycle, they're going to have to come up with an actual solution for immigration that's going to work, that's going to bring a sense of bipartisanship together, and bring about a sense of leadership. I think if anything, the Republican Party suffers from being a brand that is a bully but not a leader. And nobody likes bullies, and everybody's looking for leaders. If we go back to why President Obama won in 2008 as an underdog, he was an underdog to Hillary Clinton. He was somewhat of an underdog even to Joe Biden in the primary, and certainly did not have the experience that John McCain did on Capitol Hill. He won because he was able to project a presence of being a refreshing leader. The Republican Party has won elections and had a widespread set of victories in 2010, but has not come across as looking like leaders. And this immigration policy pursuit is an opportunity for them to come across as leaders that can work in a bipartisan fashion so that by the time 2016 comes around, they're seen within their set of presidential candidates as viable options versus what we've had over the last couple of elections, in particular some of the senatorial elections of 2012 and the presidential election of 2012 as well.
And where else do they need to lead, and how should they be leading? What other issues?
I think it still goes back to the economy. I think that we continue to forget about the economy in the midst of talking about all these social issues. Now, granted, when you start talking about immigration, or even if you talk about gay marriage, there are obviously economic implications in how we do those policies and the development of those issues. But it still goes back to people getting jobs. And I think that, once again, the American people overall, we have been distracted with social issues while we continue to see people drop out of the workforce. We don't see quite the job growth that we need. We see it improving, but it's not quite what we need to get people's confidence back up. Consumer confidence fell, as a matter of fact, over the last month. We need to see a consistent set of numbers saying that the economy is coming back around and the American people were encouraged by it. And until we see that, the Republican Party has to be aware that the Democrats have been in control of the White House now for two presidential cycles. They have been in control of the Senate for quite some time, and they have the moral attention of the American people, but they still have not been able to capitalize on getting the economy where it needs to be. And that has to be the area where the Republicans come across as leaders and come across as being effective. If they can do that, some of the hits that my party has been taking with social issues won't sting as much.
Well, and yet you found the very issue where there is the greatest philosophical disagreement. Do we tax? Do we cut spending? Do we do a combination of both? We've been having that debate here for years now.
We have. And what we have to articulate better as Republicans is that we want to increase tax revenue, but we need to increase it by increasing people that pay taxes. And we have to come up with viable solutions to create taxpayers in areas where people are not paying taxes right now. I think that what we get caught up in is an image that we believe that there are a set of Americans that do not want to work, that do not want to contribute to the American society. I just got into a situation last night on Facebook, wonderful social media, where people are talking about makers and takers again. We can't talk in that type of language. We have to assume that everybody in the United States of America wants to be a maker. They want to make the American dream for their families. We have to bring solutions that allow those people that aspire to be makers and taxpayers. That's how we broaden the tax base. That's how we start putting more money into the system, even as we make smart cuts and make strategic cuts to allow us to get ourselves back on track. But that's one, a mindset, two, a philosophy and a way of talking and speaking, and three, a way of crafting solutions that we as Republicans have not mastered at this point in time, despite the opportunity in front of us.
Are people working on that right now, considering that the Republicans lost and thought they were going to win the last election, and considering midterms are coming up and considering they'd really like to win the presidency in 2016?
I think they're working on that, and it's something that you said, Kathleen, that I think is pretty ironic. I didn't think that the Republicans were going to win in 2012.
Oh, you didn't?
If you listen to the messaging and you listen to how we attempted to connect with middle America, with independent voter America, and with new voter America, we had no connection, we had no relationship. So I don't see how anybody thought that we were going to win. If you look at the economic numbers, that's one thing. But people vote for the presidency in a way that's different than anything else. They don't vote just on numbers. They vote on people they like, people they look up to, people they want to believe in. And none of those numbers shifted from 2008 to 2012. I think that more Republicans are attempting to look at solutions, but I think we're starting to get caught up in solutions for social issues, which is why you see some Republicans shifting over to the other side of the gay marriage argument, which is why you're seeing some Republicans start working in a bipartisan fashion when it comes to immigration reform. However, the biggest issue out there is getting people back to work in a way where they can buy homes, where they can buy cars, where they can provide for their children now, and they can create a future for their children and their grandchildren. If we provide the majority of solutions that work throughout the diversity of America, we will be seen as the leaders within a short period of time, and we'll see the results of that in the 2016 election.
Lenny McAllister is our guest this half hour, author, conservative commentator. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we go to Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Oh, hello. I have an odd question, so I'm going to skip that question because that question is no longer relative
All right.
to the guest you have on right now. But I just wonder how the Republic. This gentleman is talking about the tax break and the makers and the takers, and which he doesn't agree with saying things like that, but I'd like to say that most of the people in the United States of America, me being one of them, and all the people that I know in my neighborhood and in my family, aren't out to become wealthy plutocrats. We just want to earn a nice living. Policemen don't end, firemen, nurses, teachers. These are things that people do that serve the community and don't make a whole great deal of money, and that's most of us.
Lenny.
And I appreciate Ellen's sentiment, and I think that's part of what we're doing wrong in America is we're defining the American dream only in economic terms, that the American dream has to be a home, a vacation home, three cars and a yacht. That's not what the American dream is. The American dream is the ability to live in that pursuit of happiness that is defined by the individual. So, you know, there are people that I know, that I grew up with, that I've known throughout the years that are wonderfully happy serving the people as police officers, and I appreciate their service. I know people that are career soldiers that I appreciate their service there, and they love serving this country in that capacity. That, for them, is the American dream, and that overall creates the American fabric that makes our nation great. However, if people don't have the opportunities to to be a police officer because we're cutting those jobs, or they can't get into the military because, let's say, sequester prevents us from being able to allow people to advance themselves when it comes to getting a higher education while they're in the military, which is one of the things that we're running into. Or people cannot get the types of jobs that allow them to have that middle class lifestyle. That is where the American dream fades. And I think that we, again, as Republicans, cannot allow our vision of bringing the American dream to more voters being something that only looks like Rockefeller. That is not just what the American dream is.
Thanks, Helen, for the call. Jim in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen and Lenny. I think there's three of us that are White Sox fans here. And
Brewers
that's a lifelong
first.
White Sox fan from
are
the
you?
South Side of Chicago.
All right, yeah.
But, Lenny, I tell you, it's really refreshing listening to you. My question is, how does Paul Ryan become the voice of the conservative Republican Party when he, in my estimation, is he so off base, and his moral teachings, I don't think, are anything that I have been taught in school. There certainly should be a protection for the most vulnerable people. I'm a union carpenter, retired, and thank God I have abundant living. Not wealthy, but abundant. I have all I need. And I still feel the plight of those in the poor class that cannot make a decent living. I raised four kids and sent them all to school, and this is on a union carpenter's wages and pension now. And my wife and I, this is what I would like to hear from politicians about those who are really most in need. We need jobs. We need good-paying jobs. We don't need low-paying jobs. We need good-paying jobs. And I do hear some hope in you, and I never thought I would agree with a Tea Party advocate, but if we can only get to the core issue, and that is probably misappropriation of our funds of a very wealthy nation. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
Jim, thanks for the shout out to the South Side. Once again, I appreciate that. And I think that to answer your question directly and then to expound just for a second, I think that Paul Ryan could be that voice if he's able to move away from being so focused exclusively or primarily on the numbers. If he's going to be a national leader, he's going to have to not only know the numbers, very well, but he's going to have to show that he knows people very well. And he did not do that very well as the vice presidential candidate. People did not buy into that. As he continues to grow with his political career, and again, he is very young, he's in his early 40s, he's going to have to be able to show that he knows people just as well as he knows numbers. That makes a difference. Now, for the party, we have to do the same. We have to show that, yes, we understand the national debt and the crisis that brings about with the spending and where we are nationally. But we have to also show that we have to provide avenues at the same exact time for everyday Americans to be able to do what Jim did, which is have a carpenter's wages but send kids to school. That's the American dream, allowing your kids to advance further than where you are, to be able to work with the sweat of your brow and provide for your family and maintain for your family and allow them to dream. And if we do not provide those type of opportunities, working with fellow Americans on the other side of the aisle and working with solutions that are consistent with our conservative principles, we cannot then go to the American people and primarily non-traditional voters and say we deserve the obligation and the privilege to serve you as leaders in office.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Lenny, you said earlier that the Republicans need bullies. They don't need bullies. They need leaders. So who are you looking at who would fit the definition of leaders?
I think that, and I know there's a lot of people that would disagree with this because this individual's image generally is of a bully. But if you look and listen to Chris Christie, and there are times where he can come across gruff, but there are other times where you hear him try to be reasonable, try to be balanced, and try to bring about results regardless of what the optics look like. Again, we can go to Superstorm Sandy, mm-hmm, in the middle of a presidential campaign, in October, where he could care less what the Republicans were saying, especially after giving the speech in Tampa, and said, I need what I need for my folks in New Jersey. Thank you, Mr. President. And even when he criticized Congress and said, hey, stop holding up this legislation. I need what I need for the people of New Jersey. I think that Jeb Bush is another one that has made it a point to try to come across reasonable when it comes to some of the issues that are out there. I think that Marco Rubio is trying to go down that path as well. We need individuals that are going to say that they can stand up for their principles and be strong. And sometimes if they have to push back, they will push back. And if they need to do so aggressively, so be it. But they're not willing to browbeat you constantly with their viewpoints and believe that you're going to take a diverse nation of about 314 million people and make them all think your way. The goal of leadership is to take your principles and with people that don't necessarily think your way, have them buy into your leadership style and buy into your leadership vision to bring about a better reality, even if they don't agree with every step that you take. And that is something that I think these three individuals, at least now in 2013, seem to do better than other conservatives, whether they're in office or they're activists.
Lenny McAllister, our guest this half hour. Lenny is an author and a conservative commentator. He's done radio shows in Chicago. He does a lot of cable news, written some books, and is with us for all things political this segment. We'll be taking more of your phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, Kind-Hearted Woman, a David Sutherland film, will premiere tonight on Frontline on PBS. It is the story of a woman who has faced all kinds of problems, sexual abuse at a very young age, extreme poverty, living on a North Dakota Native American reservation. And the film really looks at her extraordinarily carefully for 5 hours. I mean, it's over a 3-year period of time, but it's a 5-hour documentary that traces her efforts to keep her children, to find employment, and to battle alcoholism. So we'll be speaking with David Sutherland and also with the program director for the Community Transformation Grant at the Great Lakes Intertribal Council, hour two of our show. Back to phone calls for Lenny McAllister, and let's go to Diane. Thanks for waiting, Diane, in Milwaukee. Hi.
Thank you. Sir, are you willing to raise the minimum wage so we can make enough money to pay taxes? If you keep at the minimum wage that was in effect for 30 years, practically, the lower class is not making any more money for the last 30 years while the upper class have reaped all the benefits.
I don't think that raising the minimum wage is the answer. I think the answer is bringing back the jobs past the minimum wage jobs so that people can have a lifestyle. Minimum wage jobs were only supposed to be entry-level positions. What has happened to us in America is the fact that we have minimum wage jobs, but the career jobs that are minimum wage jobs are the gateway jobs to other jobs. Well, those jobs are the ones that have gone overseas. Those jobs are the ones that we no longer have access to in America. So we have the apprenticeships, but we don't have the jobs that allow us to have crafts and have people that are craftsmen that have careers. We need to bring those jobs back. So if we're going to spend money on anything, I'd rather not spend money on raising the minimum wage. I'd rather spend money on bringing those jobs back to the American shores so that people can have the gateway jobs with the minimum wage jobs, but then they can go get the secondary jobs, the tertiary jobs, and the jobs that allow people to have careers for 20 years, not just minimum wage jobs where they may make an extra $2 an hour, but they're stuck in poverty for 30 years.
Thank you, Diane. Richard in Monford, hi. Hello, Richard. I think Richard is working and hammering something, and I'm sorry. We'll put you on hold, Richard, if you want to come back to the radio. Let's go to Dave in Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I'm really upset when I hear about the minimum wage, what this gentleman is saying. Our country, compared to other countries, minimum wage, we're far below, even Canada. The idea that giving $2 more an hour and letting these people be in poverty for the next 30 years, well, look, they're making $2 less right now, and they're going to be in poverty for 30 years. So you're talking in circles. It's very upsetting. the opportunities that we need to be able to live the American dream have to be instilled when we're early on in life. A strong public school system with a lot of money funded to that school system. We need people to be able to get even driver's licenses through the school system like we used to. Instead of having kids walking around all the time, they're 20 years old, can't get a driver's license because federal funding has been pulled away by Republican policies. Republican policies pulled funding away and raised college tuition, took away Pell Grants. All of these create opportunities to live the American dream, and all of these have been, by policy, have been taken away by the Republicans.
Lenny.
Well, number one is a lot of things that Dave got to, and I'm going to try my best to get to all of them. Number one, what I said was, if you're going to spend money, it's if you can spend it on raising it by $2, or you can spend it by bringing the other jobs that we need so people can have careers coming back to the United States and being able to prosper from there. You take the second, not the first. I mean, people are not going to escape poverty by getting an extra $2 an hour from minimum wage. Let's just be honest about that. And anybody that thinks that we're going to be able to solve poverty by raising the minimum wage $2 an hour, where jobs will be cut and people, we're already seeing people go from full-time work to part-time work because of Obamacare, that's not going to help them either. We need career jobs, not just minimum wage and entry-level jobs. That's number one. Number two, I agree that we do need a public school system that's going to be strong and vibrant, but to suggest that we're not already spending a lot of money on public education and not getting the results that we need is not looking at the full set of facts either. If we're going to spend that money on education, either the public school system is going to have to improve the results that we're getting with our students there, or we're going to have to use that money and perhaps go to something such as a school choice system and allow people that are stuck in poverty right now to be able to use the same amount of money, and in some instances a percentage less, to be able to get their kids into better schools and go from there. A lot of the reasons why you're seeing kids that are unable to drive at 20 years old, they can't afford a car. They can't afford a car because we're not allowing their parents to have the type of jobs that they need because those jobs have been shipped overseas, and we do not have the tax incentives here in the United States from a global standpoint that allow those jobs to stay here on American soil. So I think that some of the examples that he's comparing to Canada, when we don't have, Canada doesn't have the military that we have, doesn't have the economy that we have, and doesn't have the spending issues that we have. So when you look at all of that taken into consideration, we have to have a more efficient way of spending and getting results from the system. And anything less than that is going to be not enough. It's going to be insufficient.
You think Obamacare, there's a movement to repeal Obamacare. What are your problems with Obamacare?
I think what we're seeing already is the fact that premiums are going up. People that overlook that are now starting to see that when it hits their wallet. I think that the whole idea of people getting their hours cut at work because employers do not want to pay for these individuals to have health care insurance. That's an issue as well. I think that conservatives, we talked about this in 2009 and 2010, and people went with the grandiose vision of how Obamacare was going to help people, and now they're seeing the other side of it. I think that what we need, obviously, it's not saying that we don't need health care reform, but the way that this came about in an extremely partisan fashion where even Democrats had to be convinced over and over and over again with backroom deals and things along those lines to vote their way in a hyper-partisan fashion should indicate to people that this is not the way of doing this. And we're already starting to see some of the pain from this. We need a system that's going to allow people to compete in the marketplace and drive the cost of health care down. We haven't seen anything that's driven the cost down yet. And we're seeing people lose hours at work. We're seeing premiums go up as a result. I do think there were some good aspects to Obamacare. I think that people that have pre-existing conditions still should have some access to health care, obviously. I think that people that are in school, that are trying to advance themselves with a better education and they're on their parents' insurance at age 23, 24 because they're getting a master's degree or a PhD or a law degree and they're still living at home, I have no problem with that as well. But I think the way this has been passed and the way it's been sold to the American people, we're already seeing the crop from what was baked into the cake in 2010, and there have been some pretty rotten fruit so far, and I think it's going to continue that way, unfortunately.
It hasn't fully kicked in. Do you think there is a chance that people may like it once it kicks in fully?
I think there will be some folks that like it. Again, there are not. It's not 100% bad. I think there are some positive aspects. I think if you had stage 1 breast cancer at age 24 and now you're a 45-year-old mother of three, you shouldn't be denied health insurance just because you had cancer 20 years ago that has not resurfaced. I think that those were scenarios that in 2008 you could see that we won't see moving forward, and I think that's a good thing. But there are other instances that I think hold back what we need to see in the American healthcare system.
Thanks.
That
we're out of time,
not
Lenny.
Only affected the healthcare system.
Thank you. Lenny McAllister, our guest. We thank him very much for being with us this part of the show, author and conservative commentator. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing, and thanks for your calls.